Hey everyone, my name is Matthew Remsky. This is the Anti-Fascist Dad podcast. And you know what? I'm skipping the anti-fascist dad joke this week. I'm just not feeling it. This is episode 14, How to Talk to Your Sons About Fascism with Craig Johnson.
Yeah, so I wrote this book with young men in mind specifically because young men are the primary target for fascist recruitment. And also because young men are specifically susceptible and vulnerable to fascist messaging and fascist ideology.
So that's coming up. A reminder that you can find me on Blue Sky and Instagram under my name, and at YouTube and TikTok as Anti-Fascist Dad. And the Patreon for this show is at Anti-Fascist Dad Podcast, where subscribers get early access to every part two of these main feed episodes. So I'm putting this episode together on the day after the point-blank execution of legal observer Renee Nicole Good by an as-yet unidentified ICE agent in Minneapolis. So that's my opening sentence. But I just want to pause and note that given the crystal-clear video footage of the moment, it feels disorienting to utter it with an awareness that the most powerful people in the world, those who can carry out a murder like that with impunity, are denying it. In this climate, it feels like those of us who wish to utter the plain truth are almost in a posture of supplication, uttering acts of faith, speaking what we saw over and over again into the void in the hope that we will keep the possibility of truth alive. And where do we say what we need to say? Well, I'll get to the home in a moment, but in my conversation with historian of fascism Craig Johnson today, we'll be talking about how young people learn and find community online in ways that make them vulnerable to fascism. A lot of that complexity turns around the chaos multiplier of the internet itself. Now today, even as federal agents are unrolling the yellow tape around Renee Good's maroon Honda Pilot, smashed into that utility pole, it's a family minivan with stuffed animals in the glove compartment, our screens are delivering instantaneous propaganda from the government and incredibly weak and squishy headlines from major publications. To take just one example, in the first 24 hours, the New York Times told the world that the facts of the murder were, quote, in dispute, that local officials were, quote, contradicting Kristi Noem and the president, while also repeating the lying statements of various Department of Homeland Security spokespeople without fact-checking them. And it was by toggling back and forth between news platforms and social media feeds that I was able to see something a little bit more clearly for the first time. For all of the problems with Instagram and TikTok misinformation, and I'm really familiar with these from years of writing about online conspiracy theories, these spaces remain available for regular people to say what they see directly and passionately. Yes, people get their accounts nuked. Yes, things get taken down. Yes, you have no control over, you know, what is allowed to stay on the platform, but many things get through. And now I know I've trained my algorithms to show me this, but there are all of my people, an endless stream of regular folks speaking directly into the camera saying ICE murdered this woman. And so I want to keep that capacity for honesty and directness in mind as I also think about what Craig and I discuss about the internet being a primary recruitment zone for fascists, because nothing is ever one thing. Now, something I've been thinking about a lot since the news broke is about my role as a caregiver to our two sons and how they're inevitably going to come across the news of Good's murder, and likely in a fragmented or superficial format. Like they might read a headline over somebody's shoulder or over my shoulder. The older one sometimes hears fragments of news stories from the YouTube commentators that he likes. They might come across an AI short on YouTube that basically like stitches a bunch of mainstream sources together like Frankenstein at a fast clip and then offers a he said, she said gloss in a cold and sterile AI voice. But they're going to know that it's a deep story. And so My thoughts are on how I can slow it all down and provide honesty, support, and hopefulness as we discuss the murder of a 37-year-old woman. And this brings me back to the moment that I started this project, because our older son asked me on the day after Trump's second election win, what's going to happen now? So the first thing in preparation for this conversation, and I don't know when it's going to happen, but the first thing that I turn to is the need to regulate myself, to take a deep breath, to prepare to reflect and absorb and listen carefully to the feelings that come up from the kids, but also from me as we discuss the facts. Because there's going to be outrage, there's fear, there's confusion, there's sorrow, sadness, grief. There might also be some early defensive, ironic, cynical deflection, which I think is perfectly healthy, but it can also sort of, I don't know, avoid the gravity. I believe my job as an anti-fascist parent is to share in those feelings, but to not stoke them or exacerbate them, to let them be what they are. But then at the same time, to hold a longer history within me that says, yes, we should expect the police in a fascist state to murder our neighbors. And we should remember that they've been doing that for a long time. So I think the first solid ground in the discussion is to establish what the internet can't, which is slowness, the ability to unpack facts and emotions in a space of security. And that solid ground is next to a visceral reality that Renee, as I said, was 37, a parent like so many other people they know, and the type of person you might look up to because it looks like she had the courage to stop her car and say something or to videotape these thugs. And I don't think you can share a moment like that without it hovering in the air behind you that you're just like her. You would absolutely stop your car to yell at thugs taking your neighbors away. Maybe you've even proven this by your willingness to be really loud or rude at protests. So there's a waypoint there to pause at and to acknowledge, yes, that could have been me. That could have been your mom. It could have been one of your parents, and then we'd be gone today. But I think that connecting that identification with this shared will to do something good, to make a bet that we weren't yet at the get shot in the face level of fascism is also important. And I think I would really hover on the doing something good part, because we don't know, as I said, enough about Renee to know her intentions in that moment. But there is a deep dignity in doing anything to protest or obstruct that ICE raid. And the dignity increases as the danger increases. So as I plot out this conversation in my mind, I wonder if that focus on dignity might lead to a discussion of how hundreds of people then turned up on that street within an hour of the shooting to protest and mourn together. People who knew Renee are likely already at her house checking in on family or kids. They're setting up GoFundMe things and so on. So the video is showing you these cold, desolate pictures of a smashed minivan and a bloody airbag. And then it's playing the clip of the shots over and over again. But what's actually happening now, behind all of that, or through all of that, or in the present moment, is a huge network of people are starting to reach out to each other. They're starting meal trains, they're organizing, they're doing something. Because everyone knows how much this hurts. Everyone knows it is wrong. Everybody rises up in their souls against fascism. And that's what's coming from Renee Nicole Good's blood on that street. And lastly, I also always think about the mental health cost of doing all of this for the parent who wants to do anti-fascism, because all of these moments in which you have to be a safer world for the kid than the world can be for the kid are moments in which you have to mute your own dread. And that has to go somewhere, or it will come out sideways. And, you know, without getting too wellness woo on you, I think stuff like this makes us ill over time. And so we have to take care of ourselves when we have private moments. Okay, so today I sit down with Craig Johnson to talk about why fascist movements so deliberately target boys And his core argument is that fascism has always depended on young men to do its dirty work, and that traditional Western masculinity, which is organized around power, domination, speed, and violence, creates a particular opportunity and vulnerability. So this isn't about boys being inherently biologically fascist. It's about how certain gendered expectations are exploited ruthlessly. So we spent some time discussing the internet, which is where this recruitment happens, because platforms like YouTube, TikTok, Instagram, Discord, they aren't just places for jokes and gaming. They're dense, concentrated ecosystems where a small number of creators reach massive audiences, and fascist ideas slip in through humor and transgression and irony, you know, often disguised as jokes. Craig says that racist, sexist, or anti-Semitic memes are like ambivalent social circles, signals, because if you laugh at the joke, you can prove you belong. But when adults react with anger or panic to this content, it can deepen that effect by confirming the fascist narrative that these ideas are forbidden or oppressed, or that your parents don't understand you. So the moment a kid brings a meme to a parent is this critical crossroads. We also talk about how the most effective response isn't punishment or dismissal ever, but curiosity and care. Because if you ask a child to explain the joke and how it makes them feel, then you can talk about how it makes you feel. And then suddenly you're talking honestly about why cruelty can feel funny. And these are all ways of slowing the process down. And we wrap up by wondering whether the same speed and humor that drive cruel viral content could ever be harnessed for empathy and justice, and whether figures like Mr. Rogers could survive on TikTok. So those questions hang over the rest of our conversation, which is now available on Patreon in episode 2. Hey, Craig, welcome to Anti-Fascist Dad.
Hey, how are you?
I'm doing pretty well. Thank you so much for taking the time. So listeners will know from my little intro, you've got this great book out called How to Talk to Your Son About Fascism. And it's written for parents and caregivers. But today I want to talk about the kid and youth culture that you describe in it. But I want to talk in a way that all ages can really grasp, because this is a family show. We can curse and so on, but we want everybody to be able to understand.
PG-13.
All right. So first off, why did you focus on boys?
Yeah. So I wrote this book with young men in mind, specifically because young men are the primary target for fascist recruitment, and also because young men are specifically susceptible and vulnerable to fascist messaging and fascist
ideology. Now, are we talking about assigned at birth boys? Are boys inherently or essentially vulnerable to fascism? Are we talking about sort of like core traits of, you know, sex and gender?
So I'm primarily talking about cis boys. Primarily, we're talking about boys who, you know, are people who were assigned male at birth, born with a penis, etc. There is a chapter in the book that's talking about trans kids, non-binary kids. But for them, talking about fascism is more like a warning as opposed to like an inoculation or, you know, a vaccination or something.
Right.
The reason that fascism specifically appeals to cis men is there's a couple reasons. One of them is that fascism needs young men in order to do dirty work. They need them to go out and be violent and to try to take up space, and to try to take over streets, and to try to yell at people and scream at people and make people scared, right? They want that. The reason that they want young men to do that is that young men are steeped in Western masculinity. And Western masculinity believes in, promotes, really like feels this this connection, this affinity to power, speed, violence, domination, control, things like this. And so the closer that a person is to traditional masculinity, or the more susceptible they are to it, yes, the more susceptible and closer they are to fascist messaging. Fascism has always been the most male of all political movements that I'm aware of, certainly in the modern world.
So we know who the audience is. Now let's talk about where they are or where they interact. And that means talking about the internet, which you spend a lot of time on. So we're talking about YouTube, TikTok, Discord spaces. I mean, I guess the first question to ask is, are these politically neutral spaces for kids?
Yeah, I mean, the simple answer to that is no. I would argue that there is no politically neutral space of any kind, especially when we're talking about adolescents. You know, adolescents are not children. They care about, they believe in things, you know. They encounter political messaging, and they're beginning to be adults who have opinions about politics and opinions about, you know, real serious issues. The big thing here is that you as a parent, you as a caregiver, you as a somebody who cares about a young kid in your life, you know, maybe it's your nephew, maybe it's a kid on your team, you know, that you coach, something, right? You might hear about them being on a Discord server. You might hear about them browsing TikTok and you think like, oh, it's just the internet. You know, like it's not real.
Right.
Or like, oh, they just look at stupid crap. You know, it's like funny videos or whatever. Look at some of those videos. Listen to some of those podcasts. Watch some of that YouTube content. Like a lot of it has the same type, the same valence of like transgressive humor that, you know, say perhaps the parents listening to this podcast, the older folks listening to this podcast might recall from like, you know, weird shows in the 90s, a Simpsons or a South Park, even more likely, right?
Right.
Transgressive comedy is big among young people, and it has been, I think, possibly forever. That one might, that's a weird historical claim, but, you know, it's a long time. And so the idea that a kid, that a 12-year-old might be shown a joke that they know is not okay to repeat, but that makes it funnier, that makes it more fun for them, of course, you know, like we can't be surprised by that. What's happening now,
right,
and this is somewhat different from the past, from the lives of the older folks that might be listening to this, you know, if you grew up in the 70s, 80s, or 90s. What's happening now that's different is that those jokes are being shared not to make you uncomfortable and not just to be funny, but in order to signal political in-group. The idea is that if you laugh at these jokes, these transgressive jokes, you know, a racist joke, a sexist joke, an anti-Semitic joke, the idea is that if you laugh at these jokes, well, that can draw you into the world of the right wing. And that's what we're seeing today, both in an organized fashion with podcasters, with content creators who came out and supported Donald Trump, for example, but also in a disorganized fashion. It's just become part of how internet culture works. For those of you who grew up on the internet, like me, you know, I'm in my mid-30s, I'm prime grew up on the internet age. You remember that like those strains were always there. Now it's just part of the mainstream. That's just like part of how some people engage with it.
And there's just no sort of universe in which it's not an influential set of spaces. It's not like walking around in your neighborhood where you have the chance to have and develop your own thoughts about the world, is it?
No, online culture works very differently, especially as it stands now. So one of the main differences between online culture today and online culture back, say, again, in the 90s or early 2000s, is that it is significantly more concentrated. So a lot of what kids do is that they go to one of like 4 to 5 apps and they engage with people there. You know, this is Instagram, TikTok, YouTube. And those systems produce extremely high viewership, listenership for relatively small numbers of people. This means that the content that they see is a lot more aggregated. It's a lot more concentrated. It's a lot more common. There is a countermeasure to this. There is a countervalence to this, which is a Discord server. The equivalent there, again, if we're talking in oldie time internet terms, the equivalent there is a forum. Discord essentially functions like that.
Right.
So there are a bunch of niche little Discord servers that are about niche little things. Most of them are perfectly innocuous, right? You know, I'm sure that there are dozens of knitting Discord servers, right? And they're probably really nice and quaint and very pleasant.
And healthy to be in.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, yeah. I mean, like the thing here is that the thing here to remember is that online community is community. It's community just like any other community. Many of them are good. Some of them, however, contain the seeds of something much more heinous, which is fascist messaging, fascist organizing. or things that might lead to that, like anti-Semitic content, racist content, sexist content.
And it's intentional.
Oh, yeah.
Because you and other researchers have found that fascist organizations and actors actively infiltrate online spaces to recruit young people into ways of thinking. What's the evidence for that? Like, how do you track that down?
Yeah, so some of this evidence is by, you know, watching these videos and just seeing them and being like, okay, well, obviously they put this stuff in there. They're not stupid. You know, they know what they're doing. Other evidence is even more clear. We know, for example, we have archived posts, we have video evidence, we have interviews with actual Nazi content creators. A perfect example would be a guy named Anglin, who founded the Daily Stormer, which used to be, and I believe still is, the largest openly neo-Nazi website on the internet. And he is on record saying, like, yeah, my goal is to get the 10-year-olds. I want adolescent boys to see fascist content that they don't know is fascist content. I want them to see fascist content and be sort of like taken in by it, to be duped by it. I want them to see it and not know what's happening. They're just laughing at a joke. They just think a meme is funny. They just think that something is like a silly, kooky little thing or something like that. Instead, what is happening is that they are being inoculated into something worse, right? They are getting associated with, they're getting closer to fascist content without knowing about it. And that's what these people are trying to do.
And not just algorithmically closer. Is it that the jokes themselves have some sort of content hook that lead the viewer to consider the sort of next transgressive thing funny as well?
Absolutely. So part of what they do is that they, when they set out to make these memes that are enticing to kids, because we're talking about kids, right? We're talking about like 10-year-olds, 15-year-olds.
Right.
When they set out to make these memes that are enticing to kids, it's they do them as jokes. And they do them as jokes that start out not appearing to be about Nazism or fascism or some anti-Semitism or something like that. Instead, the idea is that it's a joke that if you told your mom the joke, she would say, well, don't say that. That's not funny. That's not okay. I don't want to hear that. That they would get mad at you. And they do this on purpose. They want adults to get mad at kids for encountering this content. Because if they successfully do that, if the adults get mad at the kids for encountering the content, then the kid will go, aha, the fascists were right. And they don't think they're the fascists yet, right? But, you know, the people posting this were right. The people on the forum were right. The guy in the video was right. I'm not allowed to think these things. My parents won't let me think these things. These thoughts are oppressed. I'm oppressed. We're oppressed. And it's this really insidious and brilliant way to get young kids to identify with fascism before they even know what it is.
So that moment of the kid bringing the meme to the mom or to the dad and saying, hey, isn't this funny? That's a crucial moment, because it's at that point that the caregiver can say, you know, actually, let's talk about what that means. Or, you know, I can see why you would think that was funny, but I'm a little bit worried about where it's coming from, versus the kind of dismissiveness or the, you know, the hand waving that may not even go to the sort of, you know, length of, oh, I'm being told that I'm wrong, but I'm being told that my world isn't important, or I'm being told that these adults are not going to welcome what I think about, whereas the adults online or the people online are, right?
Yeah, you're right that this that is a key moment. When your kid brings you something and you want to intervene on it, that is the most important moment of all, because that's a real crossroads, just like you're saying. Your knee-jerk reaction is probably, it might be disgust, it might be worry, it might be fear, it might be anger. Instead, you know, you gotta really, really hitch up your parenting bootstraps, you know, put on your shoes and say to yourself, okay, now's the time to be calm and cool about this. And to remind yourself, this is a child He does not know what this is. He doesn't understand these things. Maybe he's heard about them in school. Maybe he knows about it intellectually in like a history type way. But even then, right, he doesn't really fully understand. He can't. It's my job to teach him. And I can't teach him by being mad at him. The way to do it is to approach it through curiosity and care, right? When your kid gives you a meme and you think it's a pretty heinous one, the thing to do is to say like, oh, I don't understand that.
Please explain this to me.
Yeah. Like I don't get the joke. Can you explain the joke to me? And then they might explain the joke and you'd say like, I don't think that that's funny. You know, that made me sad instead of sounding funny to me. You know, I don't get it.
Let me run another sort of avenue by you, which is that what I found in my own interactions is, you know, the reason that cruelty here is, you know, if the meme is, let's say, ableist, or if it's fat shaming, or if it's about trans people or something like that, I said, you know, the thing that's really weird about humor is that often, like, people want to laugh about things that they feel uncomfortable about or they feel ashamed of. And there's a way in which when people laugh at, you know, the disadvantaged or the person who's disabled or something like that, they're really trying to make themselves feel better about their own sort of normalcy or their own status. Is that something that you came across in like your psychological reading?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. It's a time to talk to a kid about like, why it is that this is appealing to you, you know? Is it because this is something you're scared of? Is it because this is something you're curious about?
Yeah.
Is it because this is something you're surprised by? Is it simply that, like, you've never heard somebody say those words before and, you know, they're swearing or they're saying a word that you know that you're not supposed to say? And in the same way that when they were 8, they thought the word poop was funny, maybe they think that a racist word is funny when they're 12 for the same reason, you know, just because it's a word that they know they're not supposed to say. And thinking about it in those terms, you know, thinking about like what comedy is and the fact that it at its worst is punching down, and like thinking about bullying among kids, that's punching down. I mean, like, kids think that that's funny. Kids have some cruel bones in their bodies, right? And as parents, caregivers, educators, it's part of your job to try to temper that as much as you can.
Well, this is the thing that I kind of want to get to, which is that, you know, the humor and the speed as well, which is something that you talk about quite a bit in your book, of how this data flows, how the memes explode, and how things go viral, that they are often bound up in a kind of cruel or aggressive edge. And this seems to be a winning recipe for things going viral. So I wanted to ask you, though, whether you can imagine a TikTok style or a kind of content genre in which the same kind, not the same, not punching down humor, but humor generally and speed were bound up in the opposite. We're bound up in something like empathy or a desire for justice. Do you think that's possible?
That is an extremely good question. I know that, you know, there's those viral Facebook AI created things, right? You know, about like a kid who made a boat out of Coca-Cola bottles or something, right? You know, Like that kind of thing is certainly that kind of impulse.
Right.
And definitely there's a lot of viral content out there that's like, you know, about a man giving flowers to everybody in the same park, or like
right.
people saving a dog or something like that. Like, that stuff is sometimes equally, if not more, viral. When it comes to like how to, forgive me, I hate using this word in this context, but it's the only thing I can think of. When it comes to hacking these kinds of systems, right?
I think it's a good word.
Yeah, when it comes to, you know, hacking these kinds of systems that often produce really, really destructive or evil or cruel viral content, to instead produce something that's a lot more palatable and human and relatable and kind, that can be hard because virality and internet fame in general, you know, it's fast, it's hard hitting, you know, everybody's a shock jock, right? I don't know how Mr. Rogers would do on TikTok.
So that's the show, folks. Thanks for listening in part two with Craig Johnson, which is now up on Patreon. We pick up our discussion on how fascism is made to look cool and how that might be sabotaged. In the coda to part two, I give some further reflections on parenting in a world where the powerful adults are fascists. Take care of each other.